anybody else have any issues that you think need more attention, more debate?
I think worker information about local workers, like the service industry and the farmers, is underrepresented.
What kind of issues would be important to talk about in that context?
Farmers would be any kind of government action and subsidies or not, taxes, land grants, taxes versus gentrification. The service sector, I just, you know, I wonder what the local income basis is for working class people. I would be just curious if there's a factory, to go into the factory, see what conditions are, or just have some kind of information about it, outreach.
Okay, so right now we have all these different things, or we have not enough.
Environmental issues.
Labor rights.
Police brutality.
Addiction.
See a lot of non-critical reporting now.
Right.
And you see those bylines for the staff.
Yeah. A lot of sensational violence, which is reported without any in-depth background of what's causing the violence or probing.
Right. We call that a mean world syndrome. Makes everybody really scared. SARS and like all those really scary things. I think one thing personally that I see too much is, infotainment. This idea of celebrities and like all the stuff you see in the supermarket magazines has somehow crept into our local news coverage. And I think that's really scary. We do have all these really important things not being covered, but yet we know that Lindsay Lohan failed her drug test, and that somehow is very important. So I think they have a really good list here, and you guys have like a pretty clear picture of what's needed in your community. So I'm going to let Molly talk about how community media news can sort of meet these needs by talking about different philosophies that are behind community newsrooms.
Yeah. So we find that most people come to us because they have an analysis, they have some critique, or they just know something's wrong. They know that the people that they know that are not getting into the press, that the issues that are affecting the lives of the people that they know are not being discussed in the public square, are not being adequately given proper airtime or proper print coverage. And so even if you don't have an exacting analysis of exactly who's responsible and why that is, a lot of people have a general malaise, a general sense that something is wrong. And so they come to our station and many stations to address that. And the things that we, themes that we really see important to community newsrooms are people wanting local news, people wanting the voices of the people in their community, as you all mentioned. And so localism is huge, because as you've seen more stations become automated, as you've seen them become consolidated, so you've got Clear Channel owning several stations in your market across many states, they are less likely to have a local DJ that was from the community that's deeply rooted, that has, that's in touch with the actual day-to-day lives. And so you have people now even, you know, broadcasting out of a central studio somewhere states away, giving you the local weather forecast, like, oh, I think it's a partial, you know, chance for a partial rain, and it's like pouring outside, and you're listening to the radio, and you're thinking, yeah, gee, Morning with Joe, man, too bad Joe's in that, you know, satellite studio in Colorado instead of here in Wisconsin, where people are thinking they're being broadcast from. So the point is they're not actually in touch with the needs of the community, and they, you know, even though they have a lot more technology and a lot more resources, they don't have authenticity, they don't have the same level of integrity that we do as members of our own community, telling our own story. So that's huge. Hopefully. In-depth coverage is actually something that we can do a lot of, because we don't have our content cut up by advertising. We don't have a 9-minute newscast in a 30-minute window, you know, buffered with ads, you know, headlines, ads, first story, 30 seconds, next story, 45 seconds, cut to an ad break, back to the 30-second news cycle. We don't, because we're working for non-commercial media, we don't have those constraints by having to sell our airtime in order to be on the air, because we have people that support us and value what we do and contribute money. It gives us an incredible freedom to an incredible amount of airtime that we can devote to actual news coverage. And so the ability to actually drill down deeper into a story and not just get one, two, three sources, you know, with the 10-second clip where somebody says one sentence and then the rest of what they said was cut off because there's no time to include that in the story. That's really a value that we can provide in depth. You know, deeper stories, longer stories, more sources, more in-depth coverage.
To that end, you can also spend longer amounts of time covering stories. When I worked for Clear Channel, and yes,
we'll forgive you.
That's my first job out of college. They hired me, and I had very high hopes, and I worked in news and public affairs for WUSL. And their turnaround times are very, very short. Which does not give you a whole lot of time to fact check, follow up with your sources, to see who else is covering that same topic. They're like, we need the story right away. Do you have it? Where is it? You know. And if you don't give them the story, you don't get paid. So there's a lot of pressure for you to come up with something right away, which leads to very sloppy journalism. And community newsrooms are a lot more flexible in that regard, allowing reporters to spend more time covering stories because they don't have these harsh deadlines. And no one's really going to threaten you, or we're not going to pay you if you don't.
Because you're not being paid the first
time. Exactly. Yeah. All right, I'm already not in here. So I just wanted to have that.
Yeah, absolutely. And access. We provide access to people from all segments of our community, or I would say we should. And that's also a big difference between community newsrooms and even public radio. Even people, a lot of, I know in my situation, in my city of Madison, we have an extensive public radio network, the oldest in the country, you know, fairly well resourced and fairly well known. And so a lot of times I get people that come to our station after initially being attracted to the public station because that's what they've heard, and the public radio station doesn't have a place for them. They are staffed by professionals, and they have very few positions, and they do what they do, and they're not really interested in incorporating the community voices in that way. So I get lots of people after just saying, you know, I tried to even just look at the studio at the public radio, and they wouldn't let me in, you know. And so we have a pretty open door policy, and I help guide people into good shows, formats, places that they can participate. Not everybody wants to do everything. Not everybody wants to be an on-air voice. A lot of people have an incredible knowledge for history of the community, or fact-checking or research, or, and they know a lot of people, they have a huge network, but they don't want to be on the air. Oh, my voice is awful. And so they can contribute really valuably. And so we try to take the voices of all people and the energy and the passions of all people and plug them in. So that's another key difference, is being welcoming, having that open door policy, and providing people access.
So when I worked for Clear Channel, one of my jobs was that is the press release strutter.
A what?
I need one of those.
The press release strutter. And I opened all the mail and got all the faxes for the newsroom. And I, believe it or not, being like 21, was the gatekeeper for information. And I read all the press releases and other strange letters that I got from people wanting coverage. And the criteria that I had on whether or not something would get shredded or get presented to the news director was, will this event or news story reach X number of people? So if the event was really small, it was kind of trivial, then it would get shredded. If it was like a huge event where like 1,000 people or 2,000 people were going to be there, then that would get moved along to the next step. And the other thing is, does this group that's requesting coverage fit our target demographic? And if they didn't, then they would get shut in. If they didn't, they would get moved along. And so these are just crazy things. That is how, that is the reality of how some of these newsrooms operate. And in terms of access at a community newsroom, like, we don't put those same ridiculous constraints on people in the community.
We also have, by definition, a local focus. Your transmitter only reaches so far. And so unlike some of the public networks that may be broadcasting statewide or bigger stations that have a huge reach and so are thinking about people in the abstract, thinking about those demographics and those, young white men that have all the money and kind of catering on a larger scale, we have a defined geographic territory and we're closer to the ground. We know the people in them, and we are more interested in serving all of the communities that lie within. And so it may not be statewide news. It may be what's important to a downtown revitalization of one community. And a statewide network maybe isn't going to touch that because maybe people in the rest of the state don't really care. But if your focus and your mandate is, a tri-county area or a single county or, a smaller area, can do more focused coverage and really do a better job, more comprehensive of all the people that live within it. So,
I think the other thing that we differ on is participation, who gets to report on the news. If you work for a commercial news station, there's a lot of things you have to have. Sometimes it's a college degree, sometimes it's years of reporting experience, or sometimes it's like having this network of people or connections, like what connections you have in the community that will get you access.
A voice in the right vocal range,
exactly.
National networks.
If you sound funny or strange or have an accent, they might not choose you. And in community newsrooms, you don't have to have any experience. You don't have to have a degree with journalism. And you don't have to have any of these connections. You could be a new person in the community that's interested in covering news. And you will have the opportunity to do that with the proper training. I think that's it. Oh, and last but certainly not least, something that you must consider is that community newsrooms operate on very low budgets. They do not have lots of money to fly reporters around, or give them a fancy news van, or give them nice equipment, or any of those things. So we're also going to give you some tips at the end of class on how you can purchase equipment that's affordable for reporters, and also how to recruit volunteers that don't require getting paid, and also how to cover some stories that don't cost a lot of money to report. Any questions so far? Okay. So the next thing we're going to talk about are organizations and roles.
size of your newsroom, whether it's a large relatively large operation like WORT, where we have 150 people a week come through. I started a LPFM station in downstate Illinois, and before I started that station, I was producing a weekly newscast for our community station in central Illinois, and we had, I think, six of us to begin with, and we all had editorial meetings every week. We parsed out all of the issues that we knew were going on. We sent people out to cover them. We had huge long fights into the night every week about what was going to go on the show and what was going to get cut and what was going to get bumped. And, you know, we did what we could with a few people. And, you know, when it came down to it, we made it happen. So you can do it with a handful of people. You can do it with hundreds of people. It's just going to affect how specialized your role is and what you spend your time doing. So in a larger operation, if you have dozens of people working on a program, which is the standard for commercial or even public, you know, slickly produced, highly produced programs, people are often shocked to learn that there are lots and lots and lots of people that go into producing that 1 hour program or that 1 half hour program. And that you can do that too with volunteers. You can specialize the roles that people will have and give people discrete tasks, whether that's the scriptwriter, the reporter, the producer, the audio editor, post-production. You can assign one person to each of those things, and that's their role on the show, or that's their role in the station. And if you only have a handful of people, well, guess what? You're going to be Cracker Jack, Jack or Jill of all trades. You're going to be doing a little bit of everything. And if you are successful with a small group, maybe you're starting out with a small group of four committed volunteers, and as you build the show, as you put it on the air, people start to listen, you start to attract more interest, people start finding out about it, they start coming to your station wanting to know about it, then you can grow and add more people on, and then start to free people up from having to, you know, be the writer, reporter, researcher, interviewer, editor, mixer, producer, you know, and computer techie all at once.
So I'm going to show you a basic structure for newsrooms, and as Molly said, there could be two of you that are going to be doing all this work, or there could be 50 of you splitting the work evenly. But I just want to give you an idea of structure, because there should be some system in place for accountability, not just a bunch of people reporting and airing news. So at the top, you have your news director. Now, if you're going to have a whole news program, that would be their title. Some of your stations may not be able to support entire news operation. Maybe you're just doing one news program, you know, a day. Say you just have a morning news or a 5 o'clock news. And then that person would be called an executive producer. Ideally, the news director would have one or two assistant news directors to help them make lots of decisions, because lots of decisions need to be made in the newsroom. Okay. And then you would have different producers. I'm just going to put P for producers. So you might have a sports producer, right? He's in charge of all the sports stuff. You might have somebody who's in charge of arts. You might have your political / local government producer. And you might have more like your metro person or your GA, general assignment, and everything else. so it doesn't fit into some of these categories. And then these people would be reporters slash volunteers that report to a producer. Forgive my handwriting, though I went to Catholic school. Not that good. Okay, so somewhere in here, I guess, is your assignment editor. The assignment editor works with the news director to assign stories to the producers. The producers make sure the stories get covered. So they're on the phone with reporters and volunteers saying, hey, who wants to go to the school board meeting tonight and cover that? Who's going to our high school football game to cover the championship of that? Who's going to that new play in town to cover that? You know, who's going to the fire on 34th Street? And then, underneath all these people, are, in the same regard, fact checkers and mixers. These are the people that help the reporter put the story together. So they might be calling to confirm the source, make sure that the story is accurate. This person might help with editing and getting some like additional sound, looking up on the internet to find sounds to support their story. Or if you have a website looking for photos, they're going to be making sure that the story is edited. Like I said, sometimes, this is a lot of times the same person. So you will have to do this. But you might be a fact checker for somebody else and vice versa. You don't want to fact check your stories, of course. And so as you see in the chain of command, there's accountability here. Everybody is supporting one another. The news director or the executive producer, they usually decide the flow of news. They prioritize which stories are most important, which stories get the most coverage and resources, and they make decisions when things go wrong. That is, my audio got messed up, or my interviewee canceled, or, you know, we're down here, but there's like 40 people here, we need another reporter. So they're the person really who's like leading the ship. That person's Molly. At her organization. But when you have a system set up like this, you can really plan for the way the news is going to get covered. You know, you can have meetings and you can delegate, and you can produce tasks and responsibilities for each of these persons. So you might say, this person is responsible for covering one story a week or once a month, and helping to fact check, you know, two stories. Or you might say, this person might need to, you know, help write a couple stories because we have readers. Do y'all know what readers are? Okay, readers are stories that don't require audio coverage. It might just be like something that's happening in the news, like, you know, especially with like national news, you might say, oh, and the Senate passed this bill today in Washington, and this, you know, the Senate passed a local community radio act today, and this bill would allow hundreds, if not thousands of people to access community. Readers are stories where they're important, you want people to know, but you're not going to dedicate a lot of resources to them. And there are things that if you're hosting a live news show, the host or the anchor, you know, will read in between. You hear a lot of this on NPR. They go through some announcements, some readers, and then we're going to go to Richard's story on the WJXC benefit this evening. And so you need people to write those. Those don't appear. You have to find them and write them and get those into the script. So do y'all pretty much understand structure?
One thing I want to say about this too, and the reason that it's important, the reason that it's important whether you use this structure or another one, is that you're going to be making a series of decisions. programs. You're going, you got a lot of work ahead of you. You've got, there's all of these stories that need to be reported on. There's all of these issues happening in our community that we need people to cover. You don't want to be having, you don't want to be spending all of your time focused on negotiating who is going to do what, because you could easily do that. And all of the time you have to spend kind of on administrative, figuring out who does what and who approves stories and who has the say for this or that or the other thing, is the time you're not going to be spent reporting. You're not going to be spent interviewing. You're not going to be spent doing the primary work of news, which is gathering information. So if you're fighting about who's, you know, who gets final say and, you know, all of this, you know, all these issues that are going to come up with people, it's just going to drain your energy. And I've been in those situations because, especially with all volunteer operations, people are really passionate. People feel very strongly for the stories, and everybody wants a say. And people can have their say, absolutely. And there's no reason why these roles can't be shifted around. You can have somebody that produces a program or covers a beat and does it for 6 months and then says, you know what, I'm going to be the arts editor. You know, I want to do arts reporting. You know, I'm sick of doing city council, right? It's putting me to sleep. You know, maybe they want to shift. You know, maybe I know all these local musicians that perform on the street and are not getting any attention and any coverage. They want to shift. And so you don't you can think of it, of hierarchies as floating. And changeable over time. But it's important to have a structure in place so that when something happens, particularly something big or something breaking, you can mobilize and you can go into action and things can get done and things can get reported on, covered, mixed, edited, produced, put on the air. And that's what's going to provide value to your community. And if you have to, you know, reinvent and renegotiate the structure every single story, you're not going to get many stories on the air.
There's lots of room and flexibility for this. You know, it could be like a more linear structure where people have equal responsibility and they shift, as she said. But there are a few times when you absolutely need to have some kind of system in place. One is during breaking news. Big giant earthquake happens in your town, or explosion, or what. You need to have some sort of system where you could deploy like that. The second time are when you anticipate big events, elections, for example. That's when you need to get timely coverage out right away. Or some other kind of event or you know, news thing that happens in your community. You're anticipating, but you need a plan of action. You need to know who's going to cover it. We're sort of doing that here with documentation, documenting all the things that are going on. We have a documentation leader. We have people that are photographing, videoing, we have editors. We need to have that all coordinated because we have to get all of this out in a short amount of time and then hopefully get it out within the next week or two.
Yeah. I can show briefly the structure of one station in particular or how things are organized at WORT. Chris, jump in if things were different in earlier days, but so I'd say up here is the public. These are our listeners, and they're why we're here. They're the reason the stations exist, right? And then of those listeners, we elect a board of directors, which at our station is 9 people. Composed of volunteers at our station that are music DJs, volunteers that are news programmers, a staff member, and listener sponsors. So we have a tiered board with all different stakeholders of the organization represented and having a seat at the table. And also under the board we have a staff, and that's people like me. News director, and then we have 16 programs under news/public affairs. And so we have our local news, it's called In Our Backyard. It's an evening newscast, half hour, produced every weekday, Monday through Thursday. And so that program has a producer every day. There's a daily reporters, everyone there. Then we have talk programs, listener call-in show. We have a morning magazine. We have community calendars. We have long radio hour. We have news in Spanish. We have LGBT news. We have Arab American news. We have news, science news, health news, international news, and then we have a comedy, kind of satiric take on the news. Which is actually our most popular show. This whole section is only one part of the station, but
so in a way you have it all structured around each programming block.
Yeah.
So I mean, that it's diversified and they're kind of independent of each other.
Yeah, and that's actually one thing that confuses the hell out of the public, because people have no, a lot of people, you'll find too, when you start, you know, doing community outreach and bringing members of the public in, they won't understand your structure. I mean, most people don't understand commercial structures either, you know, but we have 16 different programs and they're all unique, and you know, people may know each other at their station, or you know, their kids may go to the same school, or they live next to each other or something, but they don't always work, you know, they work pretty autonomously and independent, and you know.
And in a way, the news director is really just, if they go off track completely, then he or she will step in, but most of the time they won't.
I think of it as air traffic control. That's, you know, it's primarily, with this many people, it's an administrative role. It's not, doesn't mean that on days I'm not out there doing interviews for people, and, you know, when the computers crash, I'm re-editing it on the fly in 20 minutes before showtime.
But you're not approving, in other words, they're making a decision, we're going to cover this, that doesn't have to go back to you.
No, at my station, that's in the hands of the producers.
Right.
But
how do you know that show isn't covering the same thing as another show over there?
Because I talk to them.
So you do know, you kind of know.
There's a lot of report back. So she's not going to be completely oblivious. She's in constant
communication. So it comes up to her, but she isn't like saying yes or no. She just wants.
Unless it's something crazy, then
right.
I'm sure she would be like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah, it's different than, you know, and it depends. If you work freelance, you work for other stations, there's script approval and story approval. That's not something that we do within boundaries. There's definitely areas in which
you have guidelines for it.
Yeah, people, and that's part of the training process. That if there's something that people are uncertain about, like, hey, can I interview this candidate for governor? Have we interviewed any other candidates? Or you know, if there's something that raises a flag, they'll ask me. And that's just part of my job of being accessible and making sure that people know what the election laws are that we have to live by, what the FCC laws are that we have to live by, and what is good, sound journalistic practice. There's no possible way with 150 people that I can approve everything that comes on. So I like the model of having producers, and we give a lot of authority to our producers to assign stories, follow up, and then if they have an issue, they'll ask me, and then I usually do a daily check-in with our line news producers about what they're working on. And if we want to do a series, so right now we're working on a series about gravel mining in rivers in Costa Rica, because we have a woman that spends time there, goes down there, and has been collecting interviews over a few months, and wants to do, we're planning to do a series of this. This is going to roll out on our news program across several days, across several weeks. And so I'm working with all of the different shows to put it into segments that are reasonable and work for the. Again, with election coverage too, I have a bigger role in organizing, you know, making sure, okay, you guys are doing 77th Assembly, who's covering the outlying area, who's doing the rural vote, you know, all right, we've done governor, what about lieutenant governor, you know, and making sure that, you know, people aren't doing the same thing, or if they are, that they work together on a story. Or if one person does it, we have the benefit of another show can use their material. And so that's how we do it.
The other thing that's going to guide your whole news operation and keep everybody on the same page is your mission, and your news values. You need to really have this developed. These two are going to be for your entire station. This is going to be for your news department. What are our priorities? There's a station in Maryland, and their priority is covering environmental justice issues. That is where the majority of their resources are spent, because that is an issue that's important to their community that's not getting coverage. And because they have limited resources, they've decided that that is what they're going to spend their time and effort on.
Yeah. And our station in particular, we've decided we don't focus so much on crime and sports, because every commercial station does primarily that. And so we don't spend our time obsessing over the police scanner every day and, you know, chasing after fires and dead people. We don't do that. If it's significant, or if we felt that there was no attention for it, we would do it. If it, not to say that everyday crime isn't significant, but we feel that it's that's where commercial media, that's what they do.
Or if you did it, you'd do it from a completely different angle.
So they might cover crime that, like, maybe undocumented immigrants are disproportionately being affected by muggings and robberies.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a cover, a different angle,
yeah,
of covering crime versus.
Right. But on the other, yeah, there's other stations, like I was at KAMUD, I'm in the Humboldt Redwoods, Northern California. And it's a huge pot-growing area for the nation, and they are very interested in issues of police repression, police brutality, and police surveillance because of the nature of that community. And so they do have people that monitor the police scanner, and they actually have a program called their CAMP report, I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's their Civil Liberties Program. And they have, and it's gotten them actually a fair amount of attention and trouble, because they have people call in locations of state troopers on the radio, where their movements are in the county, what they're up to, where they're sending people, where they're deploying resources. And they announce that on the radio so that people will know. And they've been doing it for years, and it's actually... Their listeners really find it valuable, and they've been challenged when federal agents come to town and they've, threatened the station and asked them, not to do it. But it's within their First Amendment right, and they're pretty happy to continue doing it, not with the idea of putting anyone's life in danger, but in the spirit of broadcasting public information you can get from the scanner or by walking down the street and being in the right place. And they're aggregating all of that content. So that might be, that's a situation where the needs of your community are dictating what your community station's decides to focus their coverage on. And it's not going to be the same, just because they do that at KMUD means we'll do it at WARC, means they'll do it at, KFAI in Minneapolis or GXC here.
And especially ethnic media is going to have very different news values than, regular community, because the needs of that community, what's going to be here, might be more diverse because it's not being offered in the language or in the voice of that population.
Yeah.
So we're going to move on to talk about training and resources, because obviously when you have a large newsroom, or even if you have a small group, everyone needs to be on the same page, and some processes need to be standardized. So, when we talk about training, I think it's good for people to know what the values are, what the chain of command is. So, who are they reporting to? Who are they responsible to? expectations going into this, and you have to be really clear about you're a volunteer, this is your job, this is what's expected of you. Are you committed to that? If so, then you can be on our staff. I think the other thing is scheduling is super important.
Time commitments.
Yeah. When you're working with volunteers, you have to be really sensitive to this. So really getting a lot of information out of people on what their schedule is, working around that, and then holding them to their scheduling commitments. The other thing is people need to be trained on the format. Meaning, reporting for a daily news program. This is how the program works. I'm reporting for a public affairs program. This is how that program works. Making sure they know how the program is put together is super important. Because there's different styles of reporting for different programs. I think the other thing is ethics and legal issues. Knowing what's appropriate and not appropriate, journalistic integrity, fairness, accuracy, all those types of things that people need to know. Shouldn't just assume people know the right thing to do when it comes to reporting. We don't. And some people are stricter than others, you know? Some people might be a little bit more flexible or laid back when it comes to investigative reporting. And others may say, no, we have really high standards. And if we are going to compete with mainstream media, we have to have high standards for news production as well. And then this, especially, you are, might be a two-person community newsroom, but you will get in just as much trouble by the FCC as a 500-person operation.
Or a libel.
Yes. You have to know what is illegal and what is not illegal. You have to know the media laws in your state. There should be a handbook at every radio station that people can access as a resource to know whether or not their recording style or the material that they've accessed or the manner that they access it is legal or not. Otherwise, you could potentially face lawsuits or get into a lot of trouble from that.
And a lot of the things that you will learn by doing, you will learn on the job, and that doesn't supplant the need for training. Training is something that will improve it. It will not only increase the quality of your programs, but it will help retain volunteers. And that's what I've seen at our station, that people want to do a good job, they want to know what's expected of them, and they want to know how they fit in, and they want to know what the standards are. And you build that as you build your station culture. You build the expectations, and then you ask people to join you in meeting those expectations. And involve people in those discussions, but they're crucial to have. The other point too, because I've been consulting with a new station that's getting on the air in southwestern Wisconsin, our new community station WDRT, and they're like, "Oh yeah, come out and do a training, and then we'll get that over with, and then we'll be good to go." It's like, realize this is ongoing. It's perpetual. You will have people coming. You'll have people going. You'll have you know, over the life of your station, you'll touch, hopefully, thousands of people. You know, people will come and work at your station while they're in college, then they'll graduate and move on. Maybe, you know, you have young people that are moving, getting different jobs, having children, life's changing, they're needing to make other decisions. You have people in the workforce that are then having to take on a second job and unable to keep their commitments. People's lives are shifting. People moving, people having to care for their elderly parents. There's all kinds of life issues that come up that require people to change their decisions to volunteer and their availability and their commitment. So you're going to have to do continuous recruitment and continuous training if you want to have a strong and stable and robust base of community volunteers. So It's not something you can hold a workshop and then be done with it. You want to think about an annual plan for doing that. What does that look like? Maybe you do a monthly class. Maybe you do, there's a once a week orientation to the newsroom, and then you publicize that and invite interested parties. Our station is pretty accommodating, and I will give newsroom tours for one person if they're interested, or a group of people. I like to try to use my time efficiently because I have so many demands on it, but I do a lot of one-on-one if that's what people want. You know, if they call me up and they want to be interested, I talk to them, I give them a tour of our newsroom, I introduce them to people, I show them the facilities, I talk about the program, and if they're interested and their schedule, you know, jives with one of our programs, then we start training, and we have a news manual, and we have different people they can work with in the station to learn different skills. So, you know, that may look different at your station. You know, some stations have, you know, a mandatory class that you must take, and that's offered, you know, on a monthly basis. Some stations have a regular series of classes that you take. You know, that's something you're going to have to build into your volunteer flow and identify someone within your organization that's going to take on that commitment.
Is there some kind of regular process where, particularly volunteers have been there a while and they're producing, that their work gets critiqued? And if that is the case, how do people respond to that? I mean, again, they're volunteering, so it's like, we found that even what seems like mild criticisms can suddenly be taken as really wrong.
It's a huge issue. And what I tell people is that they're doing incredibly valuable work.
Yeah.
And it's important, and I don't consider it second rate because they're not getting paid. Not at all. I think there's plenty of institutions that we have in our society that are run by volunteers. Look at your volunteer fire departments. They don't just say, oh, you know, somebody's house is burning down, but I'm a volunteer and I don't feel like it. I'm going to go have a cup of coffee. You know, they put out the fires. They do the job. They don't say, I'm a volunteer, so that gives me license to slack off and, you know, do things half-assed. And, you know, you'll find people that say that, but I don't believe it. Now, I think you have to accommodate people's schedules. Their families and their jobs will come first. That's how it is. And I do my best.
But, I mean, just criticism that they're doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
How do you frame that such that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the best way to do that is training, you know? And that's right here. I try to
focus on what do we need? What is the goal? So if the issue is, you know, it's going to depend on what it is, what their offense is, but if it's something that, is a violent, you know, a flagrant violation of policy, then I would say, did you know we have a policy about that? you know, we can't do that on the air. Like, a time when you said motherfucker, like, we can't do that. You know, like, no, that's an FCC law. Absolutely not, you know. And I think it's really, it's hard for us because we're social beings and we're working in an environment where people are friends and they don't want to be considered, you know, adversarial or antagonistic or, you know, being a mean or annoying. But I think it's so important to have direct, open, and honest communication. And so you have to be direct with people. You have to say, that thing that you did, we can't do that. We got to do this.
Right. Well, I'm not
talking
so much about that, but in other words, it's like improving their skills. Is there a regular process, like people regularly do interviews and, you know, you hear that they're really like, they need improvement in that.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you need some kind of regular process where people get critiqued so that it's regular and they don't feel like you're just attacking them.
Yeah, one thing that I'm a big advocate is what I call the post-mortem. And that's after every show that you do, particularly even if it's a live newscast, you know, where it's hours and hours of work and lots of material and this frantic editing and deadline, 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 and then you're on the air and then you exhale once it's done. while it's fresh, while, you know, you've just completed your newscast, you gather everyone after the show, even if it's for 15 minutes, if that's, you know,
so
and
you
then...
So you do that.
Yeah, and so, you know, it took a while, and I'm, you know, I can't say that every show on my station does it, but I'm
right.
encouraging them, and I'm working with them, you know, and people always, you know, I gotta pick up the kids, I gotta go, I don't have no time for that, but you just build it into the culture, you just... Say it, you just start doing it once, and then you start doing it the next time, and then you start doing it the next week, and then, you know, and then people tell other people, and then people say, yeah, this is what we do. Yeah, after the show, we gather and we do a debrief, and I tell people to be specific and to sing praises. You know, we don't always want to be critical.
No.
Sometimes there's a really great thing that happened, the magic, and you want to reflect on that. You want to appreciate it. Wow, when you just interviewed the mayor and, like, you know,
that.
He just stood there for 5 minutes because you asked him a question that nobody had ever asked him in his entire career. Like, that was amazing, you know? You want to tell people those things, but, you know, there's also that case where, okay, so when we lost that phone call and the interview and you froze up, we got to do is just move on to the next story because that's going to happen. You just got to give people direct suggestions on what needs to happen, and then through practice they will get better. But yeah, I think that's incredibly important, is the debrief immediately after. And then providing, make sure you advocate for your station to try
and
to get resources.
Have, like when you mix, say someone does the interviews, and maybe particularly in a smaller station, they also do the editing and. Do you always have someone else review the finished piece before, or just trust people to do it?
It depends if you have the capacity or not, and it depends how much you trust people. There are some people that you know you can depend on. They've been doing it for a long time. They always have really great pieces. There are going to be edited a lot less than new people. And then, you know, it's about capacity. You know, sometimes you have to get the story on the air immediately.
Right.
Yeah.
Sometimes, okay, this story is not going to air till tomorrow. Let's listen to it. Let's see if we can add more or take away. You know, we might.
I always recommend it. I always tell people that that's the goal. Does it always happen? No. But
so, in other words, you tell people that they should do that. If the time is there, you don't. But
right, I mean,
try to build that in here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have someone else listen to
that's
it.
That's and that comes, that goes for script writers. That goes for audio, you know, audio editing. Get another set of ears. Get another set of eyes. Have people read it. They will, because also what you want to, you're writing for clarity, and you want to make sure that what you're doing, all of this, you're spending hours and hours and hours on, you know, what may be 3 minutes of airtime, and. You want it to be worth your while. You want it to have impact. You want people to hear and respond to it, and their lives to be affected, and it changes something in your community as a result of your work. I mean, that's when things are, when it's worth that, you know, 10 hours you just spent in the studio for that, you know, one fleeting story, you know, that's what makes it worth it. And so you want it to be as clear and as, you know, comprehensive. And sometimes once you've listened to that piece over and over and over, you can't hear that. You need somebody to critique you. And so I just build that in. And I do that too when I write stories. I say, hey, will you read that for me? See anything? You know, and then they'll say, you know, that I left out some really glaring error. And, thanks! You just saved my, you know? So people really like that. They like to feel that they're contributing. They like to feel that they added to the quality. They improved. So I think it's absolutely essential in the process. Now, that being said, you know, in the commercial world too, you have to earn trust, and that's what I tell people too. When you walk in the door, you have to build your reputation. You have to earn the trust of the people you're working with. They have to know that you can deliver on deadline, and that you do quality work. And you're gonna, you know,
you
it's not gonna happen
too.
On day one. And that's the same thing with the, you know, when I do freelance work. If you pitch a story to a new editor for the first time. They give you a really long deadline, and they want to see it, you know, like way in advance, and they want script approval, you know, and you may get your script rewritten 10 times, and you're like, this is awful, but you know, that's just because that's the first time you've ever worked with that person, and you have to jive with their editing style and their format of their publication and everything, you know, too. So that's what I tend to do with new volunteers. Like, okay, I'm going to give you a lot of birth. I'm going to give you a lot of time to do this, and we're going to work really intensively. And then if you turn in a piece that's well sourced and that's on, you know, it's aired by deadline, you get your work done on time, which is really hard for people because determining how long it's going to take to get something done is something nobody knows up front. Nobody knows how much time it takes to produce radio. And that's the number one thing people tell me. Like, God, I have no idea. It's this much work, you know?
I know for like a 1 minute story, you might spend like 6 or 7 hours.
Sure.
Several hours per minute. Yeah. Have this newfound appreciation. Yeah, you know, because people, listeners don't hear that.
No.
They just want it, you know, they hear it and they're, you know, they're washing dishes or making dinner, you know, they're doing something else, they're listening one ear. But that's what we have to do to be heard. So, yeah, so you have to just earn your trust, and then people give you more leeway as they know you're, you know, that you are going to do
be
what
careful.
You say. Then they'll give you a longer leash. So that's, I tell people, you gotta earn it. You gotta work your way. And that goes for everybody, you know. Because even people that come, we get people that come to us with intensive journalism backgrounds and working for our, you know, print, you know, newspaper, people that worked at other radio stations, people that do freelance work, you know, and they have to learn our
your way, yeah.
system, our software, our deadlines, our newsroom, our formats, you know, and so usually they're really quick, but they still have to adjust. So it just takes time for everybody.
I think to go back to your original question, like in the training, be upfront with people, you know, your stories are going to be reviewed. You are going to get constant feedback. We're going to provide you with training in order to improve your work. I always like the idea of pairing people up. Actually, your audio wasn't that great, and we couldn't use it for this report. Something that I would encounter a lot, you know, because people, when they first start recording, they don't know
they're
what
just
they're
not
doing.
Listening.
Yeah, and it's just, so, I mean, I would do something like, I'm going to pair you up with Steve. Steve is a recording genius, and you're going to work with him, and he's going to teach you. You know, really using the existing staff to, like, help mentor other people, or I'm going to have you go with Molly, and she is really great at interviewing politicians and getting them to tell her stuff. So I want you to see how she does it. So the criticism isn't that harsh when you're like, you know what, it wasn't that great, but why don't you learn from someone who does it really well, and that way you can get a better sense of what we're looking for and give you the tools to do that too. I taught radio news production at UNC, and we'll talk about sensitive people, college students, and it surprised me because it's like you're taking the class, you're getting graded,
right?
And you're still
supposed
sensitive.
To be learning.
and that was my best way of dealing with them is to pair the younger students up with older students,
yeah.
And so they could work together. So it wasn't just me being like that wasn't great. You know, that they could work with somebody a little bit more experienced that can be like, oh, yeah, you know what? That wasn't great.
Yeah.
Let me teach you how to do it. And that way they don't demonize you so much for giving them negative feedback, because I don't think that's constructive to just tell people that their work is not good and they need to do better. You need to help them along, you know, so that they're still motivated and interested in doing it and knowing that there's a means for them to improve and get better. So that's what I would suggest, you know, just being upfront with people, letting them know that there's going to be constant feedback because we want to improve, we want to have high standards, we want people to move up and get more responsibility, and the only way we can do that is by that same thing you would have in any other job, right?
Sure.
And there's no shame. You know, people are coming to this with vastly different experience sets, and we shouldn't expect that people walk in the door and know everything. And sometimes, you know, people have egos or they feel bad that, you know, they have to admit that they didn't know that. They feel like they should have known it. And I just try to toss all of that aside and just say, here's how we do it. Here's how we need it. You know, here's how we need it to be done. And and, you know, oh, that was bad, oh, no matter, okay, here's, we're going to do it this way. Just try to focus on the goal of what we need and make sure that, that your whole newsroom, your whole organization understands those standards and that, that so that it can be repeated. Because sometimes people take a few times to hear it. Maybe I'll say something to someone and they'll be like, yeah, okay. And, you know, it may take someone else to say it to them before they, you know, it sinks in. It's hard, and it's hard, particularly, you know, in the type of warm, friendly environment that you want to build. You want to have an inviting organization that has lots of people, and that's what motivates and retains your volunteers over time, is those connections they have and those relationships that they build and the good times they have in the newsroom, you know. So it's a balance, but it's one of the hardest things.
Okay, so we have about half an hour left. Move through some of these things. I think Molly went through some of these different formats. There's your typical, your newscast, you know, morning, lunch, evening, late at night. There's your magazine shows, which can be kind of like variety. You have a little bit of this, a little bit of that with the host, and you might air a few stories or mini documentaries, tell a few jokes, and report the weather and whatever. Public affairs and commentary. This is where you really get an opportunity to tackle issues more in depth and have more of a conversation or a debate. You can invite guests on your show or experts. You can invite people who disagree and sort of watch that unfold. That's always interesting. And you can theme it around many different things. You could have a public affairs show about, you know, local politics or about issues in the African American community or health issues. So, you know, you have a theme, whatever it is, and try to continue to develop that. Cultural coverage, so any type of ethnic media or ethnic news, a community calendar, that's really informing the community of different events and happenings, information that they should know. And then there's like news/documentary, where you do longer, more in-depth pieces that might air over a series on another show, or it might be a show within itself. There's many, many, many different ways of relaying the news. These are just a few examples. So we're going to talk a little bit about story ideas, because when you've been around for a long time, story ideas get kind of stale, and you're like, okay.
I did this before.
What have we not covered yet? And especially if you live in a small community, who have we not interviewed yet? So it's really important to try to figure out different ways of developing new story ideas. And I'm sure Molly could tell you a little bit about how they come up with story ideas in her newsroom. What we did at our newsroom was we would have go-arounds. You know, we'd meet in the morning, we'd have our go-around. And in order to come to the go-around, you had to have 5 story ideas. You were not allowed to participate if you didn't have 5. And they had to be submitted beforehand to make sure people had them. And people would be like, oh, actually, that was my idea. So that's a really simple way of doing it. And then hopefully out of those, you could get a couple good story ideas and brainstorm at the same time. But there's lots of other ways in the meantime you can develop those 5 story ideas.
Yeah, it's going to depend on what format your show is and how often it's on the air. We have daily shows, we have weekly shows, we have bi-weekly shows, and all of those have different schedules for story generation. So
how do you gather them? In other words, people come with these story ideas. Do you have a training in terms of, do all those people have regular contacts that they call? Or how, I mean,
yeah.
Where does the news come from, in a sense?
the germ.
Yeah. So
from everywhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of different places that we get our information. We rely a lot on email because it's a way because of the number of people we have involved and they're located all over. It's a really efficient way to communicate with a lot of people. So we do a lot over email. So we get on the mailing list.
So people are contacting you, basically.
They're sending you tips.
Both. Yes.
Press releases.
Yeah. So we're on the mailing list. Get on the mailing list of community organizations in your town. Get their newsletters. Subscribe to any publication that by a group that's of interest. You get on the press release distribution list for every unit of government in your area, city, county, state, feds, they'll all give them to you.
Going to different websites that have like policy updates or issues updates that will give you story ideas. Also just, like who's available when, there might be people coming into town that you can get access to and just knowing. So like events calendars and things like that. Trying to think of what else.
Yeah, so that's what a lot is digesting emails, and forwarding, because we just get tons and tons and tons of material, and that's where the air traffic control comes in. Okay, we have the, Attorney General coming to Madison. Bounce that out to these people, they're going to try to deal with it. Okay, we have, the president coming on Tuesday, who's going to deal with that? All right, we've got, a new interesting local play that's being, that's debuting in Madison, who's going to deal with that? So getting that information and then parsing it out to people, there's no shortage of information, it's deciding what you want to do.
It sounds like all that's coming to you. It's like, are you really going out and like calling people and saying like, what's developing before it gets into that newsletter? In other words, how do you get ahead of it?
Yeah, well, so you have to have...
Because everyone else has that information too, so you're...
There's just different ways of approaching that. One is having relationships with those people.
Yeah.
Like when I was a communications person at a nonprofit, before stuff would go out, that we public, I would touch base with the one or two reporters that I was friendly with that, I'd cover. I'm like, hey, we're getting ready to do this. Would you be interested in getting exclusive coverage rights on that? But developing a relationship with the media, and I knew to do that because I had been a reporter.
Right.
I'm gonna send you news tips, but I think it was mutually beneficial because, one, I obviously got coverage from my organization, but two, like she was kept aware of things going on in the community that she wouldn't otherwise have known about through like newsletters and emails because I was able to give her, tips, every couple weeks or whatever.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example because it's not so much, yes, you want to be aware of all the press releases, but it's not just press releases you're getting. Like, for instance, we get a newsletter for, some of the food pantries in town, and one of them has seen rapid, rapid growth, more than any of the other food pantries in our community. Well, what does that tell you about that neighborhood? What's going on in that neighborhood?
So then you start making some calls at that point.
Mm-hmm. And so then I saw in their newsletter they started doing a Friday night dinner series where they invite local musicians to come out and they set out tables and they have a free meal. People can come pick up groceries, they can have a meal, it's like a restaurant, people come. So I thought, what a great place to actually interview people. Go there, talk to people, and see what they say. So it's not, they didn't send me a press release and say, we're having, our weekly dinner, and why don't you do a story on us? But, you read that article that says, our demand is up 100-fold, and then you think, okay, what's going on in North Madison? Is this a symptom of this community not having the resources or being struck by the recession in a way that we're not seeing, why is this happening? And so then you get ideas for where you can go. But you have to have your feelers out. developing contacts. I mean, that's crucial. That's basic of any reporting, whether that's, you know, sometimes it's just neighborhood residents that have lived there for 30 years. And so maybe you go by and visit them, you know, when they're having a garage sale. And you just start talking to them about the community, and they start telling you about, you know, development issues that are coming up, you know, and how things are going to change, how people are going to be affected, or, you know, the fact that there's all these foreclosed houses, you know. You have to.
So you don't wait for it to come out. You're
it's
out
all.
There
it's
looking.
All of the above. But you have to. You have to survey what's going on so that you have a sense of the community. But you also have to develop people that are going to tell you when things are going on. So, you know, like, we have people, and that's one of the beautiful assets of a community radio station. You have thousands. You will have thousands of listeners. You know, all of whom, if they like what you're doing, they want to be. They want to help you. So we have people, you know, we had trash haulers, you know, that worked for the city. We had people that worked for the water utility. We had people, you know, all over that were just listeners that would say, hey, do you know this? You know, by the way, you know, something weird's going on. You know,
people, once they know you're a reporter, are like, you know, you should do a story on this. You know, people have lots of ideas. And one thing that I always found was that as I was interviewing people for one story, I would get an idea for something else based on something that they told me. I'm like, you know what? I can't cover that right now, but you just alluded to something really interesting, and I'd like to follow up with you for another story. And that brings me to another thing, is follow-ups. So there's a lot of old stories, you know, that you can follow up on and be like, whatever happened with that person? Or what happened with that matter in the court? Did that get resolved? So following up on things that you covered a couple months ago, or, you know, this is the 1 year anniversary of this person getting cooked, let's see what's happened since then. Another thing that was always easy to do was national stories and finding a local angle. So there's a, you know, a E. coli outbreak on, you know, green onions. Let's talk to some local farmers to see if they have any problems with that, you know. Is there merit to this FDA recall or whatever? You know, going to a local car dealership and being like, there's this big thing, you know, how has that affected you? So stories that you see that are nationally aired, that's a problem, trying to confirm that and see if
right.
that's a problem in your community, and how do the people in your community feel about that? Maybe that isn't a national, maybe that's just something that's
they made up.
Well,
yeah.
Or the, you know, the BP oil spill. So maybe you can't get to Louisiana to do eyewitness coverage, but you have BP franchises in your town. And
or you have people selling fish. Where are they getting?
Yeah, and so that's what we did, actually, both of those things. We interviewed local franchise owners, and people were actually, you know, a lot of people didn't know that they were locally owned. And they didn't, you know, and it was interesting because actually what they told us is that they got nothing from BP. They got no information. They got no, you know, no assistance. And so you can contrast that to, you know, the Exxon Valdez, and where they did send support to their local franchises because people were boycotting them, right? So, you know, and then you can open up the community conversation about, okay, so these people own a franchise that just, you know, whose corporate master was responsible for the largest oil spill in history. You know, what is their role? You know, should, you know, what does boycotts on local franchises do? You know, and is there trickle up? Is there effect? You know, and so we interviewed people. And we said, how's your business? You know, has it declined? What do you think? You know, how do you feel BP has treated you? You know, what has they given you any assistance? So, you know, you can dig at it from that way. Then we interviewed local seafood shops and local restaurants that were sourcing seafood and what they were going to do with their menu and how their, you know, supply chain has been affected. And then we also found out that there was a department on campus, a lab, that was actually doing some of the testing, you know, that was getting material shipped, you know, water samples shipped up from Louisiana and doing the oil testing, and so we interviewed their scientists as to what they were actually finding, since they happen to be right in our backyard. So there's, you know, a lot of different ways you can
go at it, a national story, and get access to the local people that are involved. You know, and you can always man on the street, woman on the street, interviews.
Yeah, people's reactions to things. The other thing you can do is studying the other side, which is very important in community. For example, it's the last time, it's the only Labor Day, I don't know. There was this big rally held in Washington on, I think, the anniversary of Martin Luther King. I Have a Dream speech. Yeah, Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin. That's another conversation. See me at dinner for my thoughts on that. But all this coverage was dedicated to this stupid rally, and it really wasn't newsworthy at all. And it wasn't very even like, well, I'm not sure what they were trying to do, but it got a lot of coverage. And for each of the reports that I saw, they only had this like very small section. Oh, and then there was another coverage on the other, or another rally on the other side of the lake in Memorial, for these people that, you know, were trying to celebrate Martin Luther King's reign. So that was sort of it. And I thought, well, why don't they talk to those people? Like, what was their rally about? How many people went there? And who was there? And I saw this over and over, and it annoyed me because I was like, I had a friend who went there, and I was like, hey, how'd that rally go? She's like, oh, it was amazing. There was about 5,000 or 6,000 people. We marched in the street. Well, like, we had all these great speakers. I'm like, oh yeah, that totally wasn't on the news. And so, you know, had I still been employed as a reporter, I would have interviewed her and other folks that had attended that rally. They didn't get the coverage that they deserved. And so you can see, sort of track these stories that you see in mainstream media, and you know, you can get the other side.
And it's not just the other side. There's multiple sides. I mean, that NPR coverage of Howard Zinn's death was just disgusting. Where they went, you know, to the extreme right, and that if they had that view, then that was all they had to get.
Right, and that's a key point, because it's not always two sides.
No,
right.
Maybe it's sides.
There's shades of gray.
And the other side is not necessarily credible either. I mean, in other words, if you cover the other side and you don't challenge what, you know, you don't get the facts.
Right.
Some context for
and
it.
That's
it's not
part
really
of our authenticity and our integrity, because we know that we have contacts, we know people, we have large networks, and we know that the situation isn't black and white. We know that there's a lot of different factors, and we have the time to explore them, and we have the duty to, and we are going to. So, you know, in Wisconsin, we've been dealing with a constitutional ban on gay marriage for years, and so the LGBT community has been almost solely focused on overturning that ban. You know, and there's real dissent within the community about whether that should be the number one priority. You know, now that's something you would never hear on the day, you know, on the evening news. It's just like, oh, the, you know, defense of marriage people come to town and they say gay marriage is evil. And then the other people say gay marriage is good. Evil, good, done, you know, got all the stories, you know, but it's actually not that simple and it's not that straightforward, you know. There are people, there's a huge amount of dissent within that community, and there's actually, you know, a fair amount of dissent on the right-wing side too, you know, between people that are very, you know, enthralled by that kind of public displays of hatred, and then people that distance themselves from it. So there's shades of gray over there too. It's really not just good and evil. And so it doesn't do, it doesn't do anyone any good to portray things that way. And you, because you have the time, you have the airspace, you have the volunteers, you can do that coverage. You can beat them. You know, you can exceed the coverage that the mainstream can do.
That's valuable. So, there's only about 10 minutes left. So, based on our original question, what are the needs? There's always going to be story ideas based on injustices, you know, and as we know, our plan has been around a really long time. There never seems to be an ending to injustices in your community and all around the world. so.
Yeah, there's a bunch of resources that some websites that we have on here. So, you know, there's things that, there's people that come to you and you can develop sources so that more and more people come to you, because that's obviously the least amount of work. But then you do want to go to where people are, and you do want to find out about things going on in your community. There's also things that you have to dig for. And filing open records requests may be part of what you do. In fact, I would say it should be part of what you do, whether that's a FOIA request on a federal level or an open records request, depending on your state. You know, we call it open records in Wisconsin, they call it FOIL here in New York, you know, but that any citizen can do that. You don't even have to be part of the media, but it's definitely should be one of the tools in your toolkit as a reporter. We have this amazing amount of government information that is available to you if you can find it.
Yeah, and it's not free either. In New Jersey, it's called an OPRA request.
It depends. I mean, they can charge you for copying fees.
But they charge you for copying
fees.
$1
a page.
But sometimes you might be requesting a couple hundred pages of stuff. And if you get denied, which happens a lot of times for no apparent reason, and they're not compelled to explain why, keep pressing, keep annoying them, keep calling people until somebody gives you something. I found that to be a very effective strategy, is to be a pest.
Yeah, and so maybe what you get is a tip, or you get a rumor. A lot of times things are just rumors, or suspicions, or people that are, you know, connected to a community, you know, they just think that's weird. I wonder if, you know, they just have a bad feeling, and you have to check it out. And so, you know, this just recently happened in Wisconsin last week. We had an issue with the district attorney that several women, it turned out, stepped forward with basically sexual harassment claims that had only been dug up because a reporter filed an open records request on a police report and found out that this district attorney, who was supposed to be representing a domestic violence victim, was actually sending them sexually explicit text messages and saying that they wouldn't prosecute their boyfriend that tried to strangle them unless they would sleep with him. And, you know, you have to... That's the kind of thing you need to be exposed. Now, that's going to be uncovered by an open records, but you have to know, you had to know where to go. So you have to get a tip. You know, so you work hand in hand. And sometimes you spend your time, you know, people send you down, you know, rabbit holes, you know, goose chases, and that's just part of your time. Stories will not pan out. People will be convinced that something is wrong, and maybe you check it out, and it doesn't check out, and you just move on, and that's part of how you spend your time. Other sources, you can get sources in the public domain and fair use. So C-SPAN coverage. If you are looking for, you know, a segment of something that happened in Congress and you want to play the excerpt, you want people to hear the thing that the congressman just said that was outrageous, you know, you can use sources that are publicly available. Want to attribute, you know, cite them, of course, but there's those. If your station is one that runs syndicated programs, maybe Democracy Now!, there might be source material you can use, and if you are licensed to broadcast that, you can excerpt from that as well. Free Speech Radio News, we have shows that do that. There's also organizations like ProPublica. Now, we're seeing all these nonprofit investigative journalism outfits that are starting up, whose sole purpose is to, you know, steal this story. They do a lot of groundwork, they do a lot of digging, they do a lot of research, and then they just want to get the story out there. They give it away. And they'll give you data sets. They'll give you research that they've done. There may be, you know, restrictions on not editing it, but those are things you can use. You can also contribute to them. They're built on people participating all over the country. They've been tracking how stimulus money is being spent, and whether it's going to polluters, and whether it's actually being deployed, and oversight of that. You know, there's all sorts of stories that they work on that you might have data from. You know, what's going on in Racine, Wisconsin, or Hudson, New York, or Taos. You know, that you know
there's something going on, you can contribute to that project and enrich their data. So that's, you know, and once you start to do programs over time, you start to build archive. And I'd hope if you archive your program, think about that. Don't just think of that's one show that you did and it's fleeting and it's gone, it's ephemeral. That's actually, you're building your body of work. And you may want to pull out that interview you did with the mayor a year ago when, or maybe, you know, a politician on the campaign trail, or, you know, a citizens group. And you may want to check up on that a year later and say, you know, so when you said you're going to do that and then we elected you and then you didn't do that, what gives there, pal? So you want to have that source material that you can build upon, because that provides richness and depth to your story, so you can pull those archive interviews. You know, there's other sources on here.
So like Bill Maher, when he dug up the video of Christina Donnell talking about how she dabbled in witchcraft, it's a great example of, you know, digging out of the ball and be like, actually, I remember that lady. And she said some interesting things 10 years ago. That's always going to happen for you, but they have a system of archive retrieval, so that's important when you are done with all your news stories, to have some sort of system of filing them away, because people come and go as reporters, and make sure that you're collecting all that audio, you're tagging it, you're filing it, so that you're able to access it later on.
And you're cataloging your sources, so you have a database of sources of people that you talk to, or that other people have talked to. If you can convince all of your volunteers to contribute to a central database, then you'll start to really build a rich network of sources that can go beyond what other media can access, because maybe they just call the press secretary for blah 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 agency, but maybe you know somebody that actually worked there and, you know, was involved in the project, or maybe you knew three people that got denied loans from the bank, so you don't just talk to the bank officer, you talk to the people that were actually directly affected, that you're not going to find their name on a press release. You have to find them because somebody told you, because you were rooted in the community. Good question?
Yeah, just a quick question about the archiving. When you're saving all of your audio, do you save the whole interview, or are you just saving what goes to air?
It depends on what your like server capacity are, but the way that I've done it in the past is each reporter would have a folder for each story, and it would be like, sometimes it'd be organized by like month or by topic, and then it would have a folder for all the audio, the scripts, like any like Word documents, any photos, and then like, you know, the actual story that aired.
Yeah, we do it by day and by person. So the stories that were produced for that day's show would be under that, and that would be the final cut that's going to be broadcast. But then the reporter has their own personal kind of cubby hole on the computer that they're storing their outtakes. And I'm bad. I actually store a lot of material. I like to save my raw files, because there may be something that didn't get into the 5-minute piece, but that was really interesting, and I anticipate I'll come back to it at some point, and I like to know that I have it in the can, squirreled away, for the next time I interview or touch on that subject. I can, and then I don't have to chase them down again. I can pull that and then build on it. So
yeah, we just had a volunteer work for 5 months doing a FileMaker database of all of our tapes going back 10 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and then you made
keywords and subjects.
You know, depending on the capacity of your technology and your station, you may want to decide what format you store those in. Maybe you store them in MP3 so that they, you know, you can fit a lot more on your hard drives if you don't have to worry about that. Maybe you want to store it in WAV so that you'll have the highest quality possible. But those are decisions, you know, you can make based on what you have.
You don't want to wind up with a trunk of tapes, which is what I have. And my mom's attic has this trunk of tapes with like random scribblings. I would encourage you, especially while you're here, is to establish contacts with other stations. Because something that I did at one of the stations is we would call other stations and be like, and we'd do phone interviews with people on the ground line if we thought it was something interesting. And we found that if it was another community station, they were always like, oh yeah, we'll do a call-in interview. We'll tell you what's going on here. So for me, I live in Philadelphia, so I'm paying attention to all this election business in Delaware because I find it very interesting. And so, you know, if I were a state, I would call some folks in Delaware and be like, hey, so tell us what the election is like down there. What are the people in Delaware saying? And what's your sense of what's going on? Because I think it's newsworthy. And, you know, I probably wouldn't send someone to Delaware to cover that. But if you get somebody on the phone to do a quick, like, one-minute interview that doesn't cost anything, and then you can say, hey, if something's ever going on in my neck of the woods, feel free to call us. We'd love to talk to you anytime. And the more you do that, the more contacts you have all across the country. So meet people while you're here and be like, all right, if I ever hear something going on in Washington, you know, I'm going to call on you so you can give us updates.
I was in Minneapolis for a conference a few months ago, and it was when they were experiencing the state's largest nursing strike in the state of Minnesota. Over 12,000 nurses went on strike the day I was there for the conference, you know, which was a public radio conference. And it was funny, a bunch of us were like, we're skipping the workshop and going to the covering the story. And so, you know, we could ask the KFAI reporters, you know, who are the local union leaders that we really should talk to get some kind of the backstory of what's led up to it. And it so happened that the hotel where they were holding the conference was where the scab nurses had been brought in to assemble. And so once we found that out, we're like, went right there. And they would not let us conduct interviews, but we did get some background audio. But it was it was just their dumb luck. They had happened to be trucking nurses up from southern states. Sent them right into a hornet's nest of journalists. It was great. But yeah, you know, making those contacts, you know, and talking to people on the ground, getting that is essential.
So we're at time, unfortunately. The one thing we didn't, or two things we didn't get to, are ethics, problem solving. But there's a couple of good resources on here. One that was not included is fair.org, F-A-I-R. Fairness and Accuracy and Reporting. I encourage you to just subscribe to their newsletter. It's really, really informative. They have a lot of information on what's missing in ethics in regards to mainstream media. And they do a lot of blogging and dialoguing and have lots of forums, lots of conversations about what ethics means to journalists and how we can continue to improve upon it. Another one that she has listed here is Can We Tape? And medialaw.org will tell you all about different libel laws, shield laws that affect journalists.
So this is a good kind of outline for conversations you need to have with your volunteers in your newsroom. You know, this would be the starting point of either a weekly conversation that you have if you're starting a program, or maybe you're involved in a program, or the beginnings of a manual that you would put together for your station. You know, these are some of the standards. You know, this is what we do, this is what we expect, this is the law, and here are some resources so that you can have those conversations. I'm happy to send you our news manual from our station if that would be helpful. We could have a whole session about media ethics because it's huge.
You take a whole course on it. We also have some resources for equipment and tools, so check those out. But also, our email addresses are listed at the top. Molly and Vanessa. So feel free to send us questions if you have any, and we'd be happy to point you in the direction of really great resources, to connect you to other people that can give you advice, and to answer the questions ourselves if we know the answer to them. But me and Molly are really excited about news, and I think it takes a special kind of person. I grew up in this city in Philadelphia where people sat on the street all day long, and you were always in your neighbor's business. So I'm like, I should be a reporter. That's perfect.
I have some of the portable MP3 and Wave recorders that we use. This is a new model. It's $99. Pretty affordable, one of the lowest cost but broadcast quality audio recorders on the market. And, you know, if you can, if your newsroom can scrape together $100, this will be incredibly valuable for you to take with you wherever you go. Can download to almost any computer and get audio. There's free and low-cost software you may be familiar with. There's more out there than just Audacity. Audacity makes you crazy, but you know, so there, you really, we live in a great time. I feel like we're so fortunate now that there are so many lower cost solutions now, from recorders to software to platforms, that you can do this from. We have plenty of people that do it from home or from wherever, you know, with one pocket recorder on a AA battery. You know, you can take this to city council, to, you know, any type of event, and record something and dump it to a computer, send it to your station, and have it on the air. So
and there's nothing wrong with the old-fashioned way, because when I said it the first time around, it was like a big, clunky recorder and a tape, and I had, like, the knobs editing station.
Yeah.
And my stories, I believe, are just as compelling and newsworthy. So any way to get it recorded and edit it, figure out a way to do it. But there's lots of resources out there. Nothing should be holding you back as far as getting the news out there. So I kind of have to run to go to another workshop, but I'm available for questions at dinner. So if you want to set up my table and talk more about news, feel free to do so. And if you guys are interested, we could start like a news listserv, and, you know, post some topics on there, questions, and, you know, have a continual dialogue about news operations in the community. But thank you all for attending our workshop.
Great.
We hope that you found it informative. And don't forget to fill your evaluation forms, which are available at the registration table downstairs. There's a box there.